The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 139.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I really have a ton of respect for. I've been watching this guy's content for a long, long time. He is a great thinker in the libertarian space, the personal freedom and liberty, which is what I am all about. His name is Dave Rubin. Dave, welcome to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
George, it's good to be with you on the Rebel Capitalist Show. I am calling you from the, shall we say, pathetic socialist state of California. So I'm trying to fix this place. You might be doing a better job in Vegas.
Well, I don't know about that. Vegas, it's pretty brutal right now. But for my viewers and listeners who don't know your whole backstory, it's very fascinating. Can you get us up to speed on that?
Yeah, I mean, at the political level, I was a lefty. I grew up a lefty. I would say that there is a stark distinction when I say lefty now versus the word liberal, which obviously right. is what I talk about all the time, meaning that liberalism used to really be live and let live. There were liberals that actually wanted to scale back government, that wanted to cut taxes, that wanted to end wars, people like JFK. I come from New York. I was born in Brooklyn. I grew up in Long Island. I lived in New York City most of my life. We had a great senator, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who talked about liberty, talked about freedom. Mayor Ed Koch, while you have to sort of be a big government guy to run New York City in a lot of ways, or at least there's an argument for it, right. He was a true liberal in that he wanted equality for all people. That's what liberalism meant to me. And that's a far cry from what the leftism of today is. When you talk about the left today, or liberalism in a modern sense, it's huge government. It's taking from some and giving to others. It's a governmental answer to everything. And I really just started talking about the stuff that I thought was wrong with the left. The fact that free speech, which was once a liberal principle, suddenly was being decimated by the progressives. And I was just very open about my political evolution and questioning the dogma of the day. And as I started talking about it, suddenly I found all of these interesting people, libertarians particularly, but broadly people on the right, conservatives, libertarians, old school disaffected liberals, all of these people that were willing to agree to disagree, that liked having political debates, especially libertarians, where we can debate, you know, the validity of driver's licenses for 18 hours in a row and everything else. And I found that very rich and open and interesting, while on the left, they just said, hey, if you don't buy into the 10 things that we believe, the second we believe in it, you're done. And I think by talking about that openly, in many ways, I kind of opened a space for a lot of other people that were seeing the same things wrong. And I guess that's why this thing has kind of worked.
Yeah, but you got a lot of blowback from that. I mean, I've kind of followed your progress since you started talking to guys like Brett Weinstein, Eric, and Jordan Peterson, and I think Candace Owens. I really started to follow your work since then. It just seems like there's a lot of back, not really on your side, but on their side, maybe some animosity, and it seems that's kind of par for the course.
Yeah, look, I left, and now the ideas that they believe in, I suppose, the progressive ideas of the day and the big government stuff that Bernie and the squad, AOC, Tlaib, and Ilhan Omar and the rest of them are pushing, I think those are the worst ideas. I think that identity politics are the most dangerous force in America today, you can see these terrible ideas rotting out our institutions right now, crushing our academic institutions, destroying our business institutions from the inside, all of those things. So they don't like me because I'm shining a light on that. You know, I don't really waste my time talking about them, or I don't really watch any of their stuff. But, you know, I know they go after me a lot, and it's like, all right, you know, I guess I'm doing something good. You know, if you don't have any haters, you're probably not doing anything worthwhile. So that's all right.
I want to go over kind of the basics. I know we always talk about kind of wokeness and the oppression Olympics and the social justice warriors and whatnot. My channel is really more about economics, investing, macroeconomics with kind of a libertarian slant to it. We're talking about the Fed and quantitative easing and all the things that's going on with the wealth gap. So there's kind of an overtone of liberty and kind of the overreach of large government. But we don't really dive into too many of the issues that you go into on your channel. So can you kind of give us the broad overview of these things that are very problematic, in my opinion, to what's going on with society right now?
Sure. Let me say one quick thing about economics first, because when people say to me, oh, Dave, you seem so different than you were, you know, 5 years ago.
Yeah.
The only thing that I've really evolved on is economics. So I suspect we probably agree on a ton of economic stuff. And I've had, you know, tons of libertarian economists on my show, and I've interviewed Thomas Sowell, and, yeah, and I've read most of the big libertarian and right-leaning economic books, and they make sense. Get the government out of the way, get regulation out of the way. I'm a small businessman now. I have several full-time employees, several part-time employees. I started a startup company. You cut taxes on me, congratulations. What can I do? Hire more people, buy better equipment, et cetera, et cetera. So when I've shifted economically, it's because I started putting the ideas of liberty into practice. Mm-hmm. So I'm very proud of that, actually, that it wasn't just like an intellectual exercise, like, oh, I sat down with a libertarian economist and it kind of made sense. Or yeah, it was just because I wanted to save a couple bucks on taxes. No, in actuality, as I was really exploring those ideas, I was putting them into practice in my own business, and my businesses have absolutely flourished since then. So I'm very proud about that. But as far as the first part of your question, sort of the main terms, I mean, the woke phrase, I mean, which we now hear every day ad nauseum, woke in essence is this idea that the West and capitalism and the American experiment is somehow fundamentally racist, wrong, patriarchal, evil, has roots in supremacy, and that it must, in essence, be dismantled. This is a complete 180 from the truth. America is not a perfect country. There's no such thing as a perfect country, because humans are the ones that create countries and we are flawed. So an imperfect creature cannot create a perfect system. But what we have done in America is created a system through the Constitution, well, first the Declaration of Independence and then the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. We have created a system that has allowed more people to exercise their personal liberty and personal freedom in a way that they choose, better than any nation in the history of the world. Even right now in 2020, even if you absolutely hate Donald Trump, who, by the way, as we're recording this right now, is bringing peace to the Middle East, which I thought was a thing that we all wanted. Apparently it's not what we all want anymore, because Orange Man had something to do with it. But the point is that we have created such a wonderful system here that everyone, regardless of your ethnic origin, your background, your sexuality, your gender, your skin color, if you come to America and you're in America legally, you've got a chance, man. You have a chance to do almost anything. And what I always tell young people when I go to colleges and speak is that for a moment, think about your grandparents. And I guarantee you have it better than your grandparents. Because there's this idea out there that somehow things are all the worst they've ever been and they're getting worse. And it's like, No. Wherever your grandparents are from, whatever that story is, whether you have an Italian grandparents or Irish or Jewish or Jamaican or Protestant from England, it doesn't matter. They came to America because it wasn't so great elsewhere. They came here, worked really hard, and made it better for the generations past them. And wokeness is trying to destroy that. The other piece of wokeness is what identity politics is, that we should basically be based... We basically should be judged on our immutable characteristics, that I should be able to look at you and go, all right, well, here's a white guy, and I assume he's heterosexual, and I see a cross behind you, so you must be a white Christian man, and thus, yeah, I must know the totality of your being. And that is so deeply, it's so deeply dangerous, because all of us we're a mesh of many different thoughts and ideas. And I would much rather judge someone on the ideas they espouse, the actions that they take, rather than, oh, you're a black lesbian, you must think this. You're a straight white guy, you must think this. Yet somehow that set of ideas has now, that terrible set of ideas has now permeated all the institutions in the country. And that is what the big fight is about right now.
I spend very little time in the United States. And I was just in Fort Lauderdale just very quickly going from Medellin to St. Bart's maybe a month ago. And I was totally out of the loop, but by choice, as far as what's going on with a lot of the riots and the looting and the whole Black Lives Matter thing. I mean, I kind of got it a little bit, but I didn't really get the gist of it too much. And I came to the Fort Lauderdale, and I noticed that they're really starting to push this with the NBA.
Oh, yeah.
And in sports and doing the whole kneeling thing. I've got a brother-in-law that's in baseball, and you know, they're having to go through this. So I talked to my sister about it periodically. But and I commented on Twitter that I said, OK, I get it. We can all push for a better society. But when is enough enough? And when are you being counterproductive by jamming it down people's throats? And I give the example of Formula One. I'm a huge Formula One fan. But if I saw it every single time I opened up my computer, or every single time I opened up the news on my phone, or on every single street corner, I'd be like, enough. I'm sick and tired of Formula One. I don't want to watch it anymore. So, but the pushback I got on Twitter, which I'd love to hear your comments on, is, well, George, who cares? Why is it, you know, why is it a bad thing? Why shouldn't we make it known that the United States has these issues? And if the NBA wants to support that, what's the downside there? So what would Dave Rubin say to that?
Yeah, well, your original question is, when is enough enough? We're there. Enough is enough. I'm a huge NBA fan, my whole life. Right now, I watch old NBA games when I do cardio. I don't watch current games. And you know why I don't watch current games? Well, first off, I love watching the old 80s, 90s stuff, you know, the Jordan Magic Bird era stuff. I love it. So that's one reason I do it. But the other reason is the current stuff, you got to watch a Black Lives Matter logo on the court the entire time. Why do we watch sports? We watch sports to escape. You know, the way politics has now infected, when I said before that it's infected all of our institutions, when it affects sports to the point where if you turn on ESPN, I would welcome anyone watching this video right now, pause it for a second and turn on ESPN if you still have cable. And I'm going to tell you that there's a 75% chance that on ESPN right now, they're discussing race or they're discussing something political. That right. is a problem. That isn't to say that an athlete can't express their opinion. They can express their opinion all day long if they so choose. But by the way, if you express your opinion all day long, you might pay some repercussions for that. That in and of itself is not cancel culture. But, you know, the Kaepernick thing was an interesting one because everyone kept saying, well, this is an assault on free speech. But actually, it was an entire defense of free speech across the board because Kaepernick got to say what he wants. Certainly the government didn't stop him. Then the 49ers and any other team can decide whether they want him on the team or not. They can look at his statistics and they can go, you know, if this guy was about 20% better, we could put up with all the distractions. But at this level where he's at, you know, and he lost something like 16 of his last 20 games. So it's not like he was at the peak of his thing. But if he was at a, you know, let's say Tom Brady peak yeah. level, then he would have probably had more of a leash to say stuff. But at the end of the day, these guys, the businesses are in business of business. And a right. team is in the business of making money. And if you're going to go, this guy's just creating a headache for us, then we're going to crunch the numbers and we're going to go, we don't need him. But everyone exercised their free speech. Kaepernick got to kneel or not kneel, and he could do whatever he wanted. The team could decide to keep him or not. The fans can decide to either buy his jerseys or not. And even the president can say whatever he wants. He didn't use the power of government to stop Kaepernick from doing anything, in which case I would have obviously stood up against that. But the president is entitled to free speech as well. So it was actually a good exercise of free speech. But to get to your original point of when do we cross that threshold, I think we're there. Every time you turn on sports, there is some political message or there's players boycotting a playoff game because of racism and all that. And whether you think that the issues they're talking about are real or not is actually secondary from them doing their job. And their job is to play football or play basketball or play baseball. And if every time I turn it on, I got to be slapped with more politics, I will gladly watch Michael Jordan, you know, duke it out with Clyde Drexler in the 92 NBA Finals. That'll be just fine with me.
Yeah, exactly. And my point to these people on Twitter was, how much are you moving the needle there? Like, is there anyone that's on, like, let's say a racist that's just on the fence? Like, should I be a racist? Should I not be? Well, my gosh, I see it on the NBA all the time, so I'm going to decide not to be one now. Or is it actually counterproductive where you're just annoying so many people that they're just going to turn it off and they're just going to just disregard whatever you have to say in the future?
I think you can go further than that, actually. I think you're right. Nobody's going to say, okay, there's the sign, I'm not a racist anymore. We know that, right? But I think what you actually could do is the 180 of that, which is that the average person who's not a racist, because most people are not racist, the right. average person, when you keep injecting racism into every conversation, it's not that you're going to make them a racist, but you're going to make everyone conscious of racism all the time. And that is an odd, that is a slippery slope to racism. That if everyone is thinking about race all the time, that suddenly are you going to treat black people differently? I thought we all wanted to be treated equally. But if your obsession is with race, so I would say in many cases, it's the anti-racists who are the most racist right now. That's not to say that there aren't some white supremacists out there or some mean people and some real racists. Of course there are. And they're always going to be. It's part of the human condition. But the people who purport to be the anti-racists are the ones making everything about race. I don't care if I watch a basketball game, if everyone on the court is black or everyone on the court is white, or we got 50-50 mix or 75-25. I care, can they play basketball? As I'm sure you, when you're watching F1 racing, you don't care what the color of the driver's skin is. Can you drive a car? We're good to go. And that's how most people feel about sports. I my whole life I've played basketball. I've never been on a court that anyone cared about the race of anybody. I've played with every race and nobody cares. Do you know how to play? Can you play? Can you score? You can play with me.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
So let's talk about the current issues with the virus and personal liberty or sure. lack thereof. And when this first came out, I was doing videos on the coronavirus with the help and the advice of my friend Eric Townsend, who runs a podcast called Macro Voices, back in January, late January. And back then, my initial concern is that it would get this bad, but also I kept thinking back to 9/11 and the Patriot Act. And then I start seeing all these lockdowns and people who, and back then, you know, we didn't have a lot of data. My thing was, okay, this is probably going to be worse than the flu, but I don't think the government should get involved. I think the government should give us the data that they have when they get it, and then let people and businesses make their own decisions. Because if we go down this path, again, like 9/11, we're going to cross a threshold where we won't come back from. In 2030, we fast forward 10 years, and we're going to have a lot fewer personal liberties than we did just in 2019. So I'd love to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, the slippery slope thing, I mean, look, you could argue that from you talking about this thing in January, right when it started bubbling up, you know, people pretend, oh, I was talking about it in 2019, and, you know, everybody's trying to out BS everybody about when they started talking about it, right? But the mission creep of this thing, that's what I'm worried about. And I think that's what you're getting to about the Patriot Act. That if you think about it this way, what were we told back in, say, March when the lockdown started? We're going to flatten the curve. That's what we're told. We're looking at numbers. We're going to flatten the curve, and then we'll open everything up. Should take about 2 weeks.
Just for the hospital space.
For hospitals mostly, right? Because we don't want the hospitals to be overwhelmed, because then that causes a cascading situation throughout the country. We are now 7 months into this thing, roughly, and no one says the phrase flatten the curve anymore. We don't even talk about that phrase anymore because we're well past that. We're at a point where it is now purely political. Look, I'm here in SoCal, in LA, where it is 85 and sunny every day. Now, the last 2 weeks, it happens to be 110 and fires coming out of the sky. But generally speaking, it's 85 and sunny. Yeah. And everyone here is healthy. Everyone here eats right. You go to, you know, the supermarket, everyone's in tank tops and tan and young and looks good. And that is not the totality of their health, obviously. You could look good and still be sick. But I bring it up because when I'm in a supermarket now and everybody's in a mask and you're looking around, I haven't heard someone cough or sneeze in months. I can't even remember. Because now nobody sneezes or coughs anymore publicly. They're afraid that they're going to be dragged off to the gulag.
Yeah, exactly.
So we have healthy people that have completely changed the way they live. And what I'm worried about is, you know, just having a mask. So you go out, you got a mask on like this. Now, if you have sunglasses, nobody can see, and now you're like this. You know, we're already spending, you know, huge portions of our day online. But our ability to communicate with each other as human beings, that you can sit across from someone, look them in the eye, shake their hand, hug somebody, see your mom, whatever it might be. I haven't seen my mom since February back in New York. You know, she's over 70. And she has a pre-existing condition, and she's worried if I hop on a plane. Now, we've talked about it. We're trying to figure out what to do. But there's many situations like that. People who have passed away and you can't go to your grandparents' funeral. I mean, some horrific, really horrific stories. But more concerning to me than the virus, especially at this point, is the lockdowns, and that we are destroying businesses, we are destroying lives, and I think there is untold horrors coming down the pike because of what we have done to people.
And the government has crossed a line where if they're willing to come in and just shut down businesses and just immediately do these things with just overnight, then let's say we get this in the rearview mirror, let's say it's like the Spanish flu where it's kind of a three waves and next summer we're done with it. But then the next thing that comes along, well, now all of a sudden government, we've set a precedence where if we did it back in 2020, well, why can't we do it again because of XYZ reason? And we're going to go to that place of kind of a police state a lot faster in the future than we otherwise would have.
Well, not only that, but think about the almost subliminal message that you send to the entrepreneur, to the small business person. If you own a pizza shop, you own a shoe shop, whatever you own, well, it's already hard, right? I mean, they do the numbers on this. They crunch the numbers. Something like 90% of restaurants fail in their first year normally. So that is a seriously tough line of work to do that people put their livelihoods and their blood, sweat, and tears into. Now, not only do you have to battle competition and, you know, hopefully having a menu that people like and all this stuff that makes the food service industry so difficult. But now you also have to go, oh, and by the way, at any moment, the government could just shut me down for 6 months and I'm going to have to, rejigger my entire store to now only seat four tables outside and only be pickup and everything else. It's not a functional way for people to live. And I just moved. I'm still in LA, but I'm in walking distance to a couple of restaurants here. And I haven't seen any of them open yet. And it's sad. When I look in those windows, there's an old school pizza place. Just looks like a New York City pizza joint. And I look in that window and it looks, I'm from New York. So when I see an old school pizza joint, I'm like, man, I want to go there. I want to see what's going on there. In this place, there's a little bar. It looks like Little Italy. It looks fun and good for families. And I look in there and I'm like, this is sad. What they have done to, it's the name, I don't want to give the name of the place, but it's the name of a woman. And what I think that this woman, it's either hers now or maybe it's her kids or something. It looks like it's been there for a long time. What they have done to this family, and there's a gajillion examples of that.
Yeah, that's right. And also the liability. You're going to have much more costs as a small business owner because if someone comes in and let's say they were to get the virus and say they got it at your establishment, then there's all these lawsuits. Your insurance rates are going to go through the roof. There's just a lot of unintended consequences that is going to be a result of the government getting heavy-handed with what's gone on. And, I spoke to a gentleman on FinTwit named Jim Bianco, just to give you some context, and he pointed out the fact that during the GFC, economic output went down by 6%. So it went from 100% down to 94%. Mm-hmm. That gave us the GFC. And if you take it down to 75%, that gave us the Great Depression. So if you think back in March and April, everyone is saying, well, if we could just get back up to 75% economic output, you know, we could kind of see the light at the end of the tunnel. But they don't understand that that just gets us back to the Great Depression. And once we get done with these stimulus checks and the mortgage, you know, moratoriums and whatnot, I don't see, I think there's what we say in our business, is there going to be a V-shaped recovery, sure, in the stock market, but it doesn't necessarily mean that there's a V-shaped recovery in the real economy.
Look, we've added an element of fear and uncertainty on top of the fear and uncertainty of the virus, right? So it's like, if you, anyone that's listening to this, if you were to think about in your neighborhood, somewhere there's an office building. That office building is most likely empty right now. Think about what it'll take for that office building not to be empty. You need a mayor that's going to put his butt on the line. You need a governor who's going to put his butt on the line. You need local officials and your local congresspeople to all be willing to say, enough of this. We got to start going out and living again. Just, you know, we're not supposed to be hamsters in a cage. And in many ways, that's what we are at the moment. That's not diminishing the reality of COVID. But, I, you know, actuaries, what do they do for a living? They're always managing risk to decide how much, you know, you're going to have to pay for health insurance or car insurance or whatever else. And that's a it's a cold, hard reality, right? You're going to have to pay more for insurance if you're elderly and you have pre-existing conditions and you smoke and whatever else versus a 20-year-old who's young. And I think we have to start having some honest discussions about, all right, let's open up. I mean, my personal choice at this point would be you open up the entire country. You tell every establishment, you set your rules. Make it, whatever your rules are, make it very clear. If you want to have someone taking temperatures at the door, so be it. If you want to open up at 50% capacity, so be it. Let them do it. And then after a few weeks, let's see. And you know what? There might be some bump. There might be some deaths. But that the unfortunate reality is there that it exists. Life is risky. You could walk out the door of your house and get hit by a car. It's just a fact.
Yeah. And that gets us to herd immunity faster.
And right, so right now we're slowing down the herd immunity. How are we supposed to get to herd immunity if we won't let young people get sick, even though we know young people are surviving at something like 99.997%?
Okay, Dave, I know you're short on time, so I want to take it back to economics.
Yeah.
And in my opinion, over the next 2 or 3 years, what's going to be a big thing to watch is the social unrest, whether you want to call it the riots or the looting. And I'm quite concerned going into the election. And then also something that I don't think a lot of people are talking about, but my good buddy Peter Schiff has mentioned several times, and that's that if we go into this trial with the George Floyd case, if those individuals are acquitted for whatever reason, I'm not saying they should be. I'm not saying they should
I got
be.
You.
I don't have an opinion on it. But I'm just saying if this happens, if you're an investor, and you're looking at the macroeconomic landscape, you've got to factor in the probabilities of what could happen with social unrest and how that would play through the economy, the stock market, the housing market, et cetera, if A, Trump wins, or then B, if these if the officers or individuals involved with the Floyd case get off the hook for whatever reason. So what do you think about the social unrest component? What do you think the end game is for the social unrest we're seeing? And then I'll try to kind of tie it into the economic component.
Yeah, I mean, it's not going away. It's not going away, and it will get worse before it gets better. And the thing that I'm most worried about is, you know, we're about 6 weeks roughly from the election, and you can already feel it in the media. They're priming us to not be able to have a result on election night, and we're going to be fighting it out in the courts for weeks. And it's like, you know, unfortunately, the Democrats, for the most part, and the media establishment, for the most part, they never accepted the results of 2016, and they tried an impeachment, and they've tried to undermine Trump along the way the entire time. Now, you may not like Trump, and that's just fine, but the issue here is that they're basically saying, if Trump wins by a hair, it'll be because of some sort of fraudulent voting, and if Trump, they're even trying to make it sound like if Trump wins by a landslide, it's still because of fraudulent voting. So I think that's the problem, because this is not completely a two-way street here. In other words, if Trump wins, it's like guaranteed violence from the left. We know it because they're doing it right now. But try to imagine it the other way. Let's say Biden wins by, you know, couple elect, it's relatively close, but he wins by a couple electoral votes, wins the popular vote. It's hard to imagine Trump supporters or conservatives, certainly libertarians, rioting in the streets. They may not be happy with the election, but I don't think you're going to see mass violence coming out of the right. So people like to equate everything. The left and the right are just as bad as each other. Now, these things are cyclical, and sometimes one is worse and the other is worse. The left happens to be much sicker at the moment. So I think we're going to see a lot of unrest, unfortunately. I think there's no way around it. And I think the only way it burns out is that if Trump really wins big, I mean really big, that maybe the last remaining decent liberals, and there are not many of them, but maybe they decide to clean up their own house. Because you don't want the Republicans having to clean up that house. You want them to clean up their own house. So that's really the hope right there.
You're talking about the Seattles, the Portlands, the mayors getting in there and actually...
The liberals, in effect. It's not that Seattle and Portland and New York City are suddenly all going to be governed by Republicans. That's not going to happen. But right. What could happen is you might get some more moderate liberals who at least have some respect for law and order. I think that's a little bit of how we get a reset. But if Trump loses, all of those people are going to be that much more emboldened. And then I don't even really want to think what will happen after that.
Yeah. And do you think we could see a component of that with these trials?
I think you made a good point that the trial, oddly, someone can fact check me on this, but if I'm not mistaken, the officer is being charged with third degree manslaughter.
I have no idea.
And I'm pretty sure on this, but I can definitely be fact checked on this. And from what I understand, that third degree might be a bit much because then that brings in the element of intent. And if that's the case, there's a debate whether was he actually trying to kill him. We can debate all these things all day long, but that if you had gone for a lesser charge, it would be an easier case, and then he would be put to jail. Versus now, they've made it a very complex case, and that will just add to more chaos if the officer gets off.
Yeah, and I think that as investors is something we need to be cognizant of, and we need to be watching very thoroughly in the future. And as well as Dave Rubin's show. So on that note.
Very clear. That's a hell of a segue right there. I like it.
Yeah. So for my viewers who want to find out more about what you do, the show, everything you're doing on social media, where should they go?
Check out RubinReport.com, which is powered by my tech company, Locals.com. If you believe big tech is a big problem, I started a tech company to fight it. And then, you know, we're Rubin Report on YouTube and Twitter and all that good stuff.
Awesome, Dave. I appreciate it. I can't wait to do it again.
Enjoyed talking to you, and good luck fighting for capitalism, man. We've still got a chance.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.